Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For all the political sound and fury over the offshoring of American jobs to India, China, and beyond, the coming great migration of American work to foreigners has barely begun, says Princeton economist Alan Blinder. Soon, and for years to come, Americans are about to be astounded by the exodus of jobs to low-wage nations. Essentially, says Blinder, everything that can move will move. He calls it the third industrial revolution. He says we're completely unprepared. He says Americans who want to work in this revolution will need to be in personal services. Up next on Point, the offshoring revolution and the dog-walking, hair-cutting, taxi-driving economy to come. Can it work? Joining me first from New York is John Hilsenrath. He's a longtime economics reporter and now editor for The Wall Street Journal. John, thanks for being with us.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing about offshoring, outsourcing for a long time. What's the trend? Is it still galloping ahead?
Yeah, you know, it first started heating up around the elections in 2004. There were a lot of studies done on the subject then, and you know, with Bush going to India, I think people are starting to pay attention to it again. You know, from what we can tell, and I think Professor Blinder will echo this, there certainly has been a fair amount of outsourcing of service sector jobs, you know, things like computer programmers, but it hasn't been the kind of great wave that would have caused a huge disruption in the economy to date. In fact, you know, we have an unemployment rate below 5%, which helps to prove that.
Right.
The numbers suggest that, you know, that maybe, you know, 200,000 to 300,000 jobs a year in the last couple of years, maybe even less than that, have been offshored, which might sound like a big number, but you know, when you consider that every month there's about 4 million jobs created and destroyed in the economy, it's it kind of gets lost in much broader churning that goes on in our labor markets.
So we may be in the early days of this, but we read reports that the offshoring is moving up the food chain to architecture, accounting, law, publishing, finance, insurance, right on down.
Yeah, this is the point that's really interesting. It's most troubling, and it's also the area, you know, where there's some chances to look at what's happened to date. There's a lot of concern that that job losses are moving up the food chain to outsourcing. But I've crunched some of these numbers. You know, a couple of years ago, there was a report by a group called Forrester Research where they ranked hundreds of different occupations by how likely they were to be outsourced. So I've gone back and looked at some of those occupations, you know, like financial analysts, budget analysts,
right,
credit analysts, paralegals, tax preparers. And what you find when you look at the occupations that the experts say are most likely to be outsourced is really interesting. The folks at the bottom of the food chain with the lower wages and lower skills have seen net losses in jobs since that report, you know, since these concerns about outsourcing have taken place. But the folks at the top of the food chain have actually seen increases in jobs in the last few years. For instance, you know, computer software engineers, if you look between 2000 and 2004, there's been a large increase in employment in that sector in the last few years. So the one theory that would explain why this is going on is that, you know, as we lose lower skilled jobs, you know, stuff that can be easily automated, it forces people to kind of move up the food chain and find new ways to create comparative advantage. So kind of just to sum up, there's certainly a fear that these higher-end jobs are going to disappear, but if you look at what's actually in the numbers right now, it hasn't really shown up. Radiology is another good example. You know,
reading the X-rays.
Reading the X-rays. That seems like an area that's easily outsourced. You go to a place like Iowa or Nebraska, and you're likely to find shortages of radiologists. And radiologists tend to make a lot of money these days because they're in such short supply in this country.
Of course, John, there's a lot of ways to offshore. Some aren't just shipping jobs; it's shipping industries. We're hearing just in the news today, GM and Delphi announcing $100,000 hourly workers to be let go, 30,000 jobs cut there. I guess in a way that's shipping some portion of those jobs to, what, you name it, Japan, Korea, maybe one day China, to build cars?
Yeah, and also to South Carolina and Mississippi.
Yes.
You know, the Japanese automakers are certainly eating GM and Ford's lunch right now. And, you know, the Korean automakers, for instance, are doing a pretty good job too.
That moves more than one direction, but, as you say, with them having their own factories in this country.
The other piece of this outsourcing debate is something that's called insourcing. You know, in some ways, the Toyota and Honda might have an advantage right here in the United States because they're going to non-union states where they could, you know, afford lower wage labor, even here in the U.S.
And Americans learning to say we'd rather have that than no job at all. John Hilzenrath at the Wall Street Journal, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure thing, my pleasure.
John Hilzenrath joined us from New York. Joining me now from Princeton, New Jersey, is Alan Blinder, professor of economics and co-director of the Center for Economic Policy Studies at Princeton University. He's former vice chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve. He is author of the recent foreign affairs article, Offshoring the Next Industrial Revolution. Alan Blinder, thanks for joining us.
Well, glad to be here, Tom.
So here we are. We've all followed the headlines, but you tell us that the headlines barely began to capture what's coming, that we've just got a toehold on this new continent of offshoring. What do you see coming down the pike?
Yeah, that's right. It's a great irony here that there's been so much ink spilled and verbiage over this phenomenon of offshoring of service jobs, which up to now is very, very small, as John Hilzenrath just said.
Mm.
It looks to have been, as best we know, and we don't have very good data. That's one side point. Only a few hundred thousand a year, but I believe it'll be much more. And I think the way you want to think about this is that the limits to offshoring of service jobs are going to move pari passu with the limits to technology. And if you think about it that way, it's a little bit scary because here we are already this year. We see lots of things can be delivered electronically that probably 20 years ago we never imagined.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me think about, you know, how many things are going to be deliverable electronically 20 years from now.
So give us a little mental adjustment on scale. We've been upset by 200,000 or 300,000 jobs going abroad. What might this scale up to as the technology permits more to happen? Prepare us.
Well, when I try to look very roughly at the numbers, my estimate was, and it's really, really a rough estimate, I want to emphasize that, as something in the range of 30 to 50 million of what we now have as jobs in the United States could be, and I want to choose my words advisedly here, vulnerable to this sort of foreign competition. Now, I want to emphasize, that doesn't mean they all go abroad. For example, the entire manufacturing sector, every single job is vulnerable to foreign competition. And as we know, the share of manufacturing jobs in U.S. employment has dwindled substantially since it peaked around 1960-ish. But it's not zero by any means. We still have about 14 million Americans making things that go into boxes.
Which are jobs, but you're saying jobs that could go 30 to 50 million out of how many jobs are there in the U.S.? 150
about
million?
About 140.
140 million.
Or about 140. So you're talking about a number that's in the range of a quarter to 30% of the workforce. But I want to emphasize, they're not all going to go. And new jobs are going to be created. I think that's the point when you think of – that was the reason I used the phrase next industrial revolution.
Well, talk to us about that, because whether they all go or just a substantial portion of them, those are huge, huge society and economy-changing numbers you're talking about.
Exactly.
To the extent that you're putting this label revolution on it, next industrial revolution, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's exactly the point, that when you have job migration, and you want to think of it as job migration, that is new jobs being created, old jobs being destroyed, you can set up, when it's large enough, you get tremendous societal changes of all sorts. Think about the first Industrial Revolution. So that was the movement off the farm and into the factory and shop, basically, into the city.
Yep.
In Jefferson's time, 85% or so of Americans worked on farms.
Mm-hmm.
Now 2%, less than 2% of Americans work on farms.
So we went from farms to town and then from, what, the steel to silicon, the kind of
electric. Steel to silicon to suburbs. So the second Industrial Revolution is the one that's still in train, basically, and it's moving out of manufacturing in the rich countries into services.
But you're describing even services going abroad in some very considerable degree. So what's the destination for this new revolution?
That's why I call it the third Industrial Revolution, is some of those services are going to migrate abroad. And as John Hilzenrath mentioned also, there'll also be some onshoring. Some jobs will come to America because we have a comparative advantage.
30 to 50 million?
It's frankly hard to see where they're going to come from, but what we know from history is they will come. What I sometimes ask people to do is try to imagine yourself in Thomas Jefferson's shoes.
Yeah.
He was about as smart as they came. And tell him that now 85% of Americans earn their living on farms, and in the distant future it's going to be 2%. And say, well, where are the other 83% going to be working? He couldn't have known.
Ellen Blinder, you say that what we've seen so far is just the tip of the iceberg. So what does the rest of that iceberg look like? Over how many years, these 30 to 50 million jobs becoming vulnerable, many going?
I think you should think in terms basically of a generation. I think that 25 years from now, this picture is going to look radically different than it does today. This is a phenomenon that's creeping up on us. The biggest single place these jobs are going, as we know, is India. And India has tremendous infrastructure problems. You're already reading some occasional stories of jobs that were offshore to India coming back. Not that many, but some are. You're reading of labor shortage in certain skills in India. You're certainly reading of inadequate telecommunications and other things in India.
So now, it's going to be by fits and starts, but you're saying it's going to happen. The plug's pulled on the bathtub here. I mean, the bathwater is draining.
Right. Yes, I think it's draining slowly, but it's draining, yes.
And what refills it? You say impersonal services, that is, that can be delivered electronically over long distances, they go. Personal services replace it, and that brings to mind manicurists and lawn care. I mean, how do you build an economy on that? I know it has heart surgery as well, but how many heart surgeons do you need? Paint the picture. What is next? What's for us?
Well, I was going to start with medical, as you said. One of the biggest growth areas in our economy is healthcare services. So that goes all the way from the heart and brain surgeon all the way down to the practical nurse. Almost all of that. Now, people talk about radiology, where there's a little bit of offshoring, but almost all of that, and it's a big and fast-growing sector, needs to be delivered personally.
But how many of us can be employed in tinkering on each other's bodies? And does that float an economy?
It does, sure. I mean, in some sense, it's a fault in our measurement system. If we're healthier and living longer, that's a huge benefit to society, which we measure very imperfectly. But
as an economist, if I scratch your back and you scratch mine and we both like it, it feels good, can we build an economy on that? We don't make a product. We don't service necessarily even a computer. We give each other massages. Is that an economy?
Well, I would rather not use the analogy to a massage parlor.
Right.
Think of it as all, you know, markets are basically trading bazaars where you have something I want, I have something you want, and we swap with each other. That's the essence of markets, whether they're goods or services. So the way I'd rephrase your question is, can we keep going towards an economy that has a relatively larger share of services? I'd answer yes. And then secondly, a relatively large share of personal rather than impersonal services. And I'd answer yes, because I think we have to.
Okay, so if you're cleaning my teeth then, and I'm cleaning yours, what kind of standard of living do we have? Can we have the American standard of living as we've known it?
Yes, I think we can. And I think the past industrial revolutions that we've gone through have proven that we can. What we do have is a mass.
They proven that? We went from growing wheat to building machinery, and then from building cars to building computers. That
Correct.
Those seem to my lay mind like a different thing than manicures and heart surgery.
No, I don't think you should think of it as – I think you should think of it as more the same than different. And the thing you should keep in mind is that as that transition from the farm to the factory and so on up the chain progressed, the American standard of living went up. Now, I think what Americans have to expect realistically is the gap between our standard of living and the standard of living, say, in China and India is going to – constantly narrow.
Does that mean ours goes down?
No. It means that ours goes up, but slower than theirs. And they gradually, and I want to emphasize gradually, catch up to us. Indeed, they've been doing that now for about, well, in China's case, already a generation. In India, it's a little bit shorter time frame than that. And that'll continue. So while I think we can stay at the top of the heap, as we look down the heap, the rest are going to be gaining on us, or many of the rest.
Alan Blinder, economists can, and by training, discuss all this in sort of bloodless terms. But the earlier industrial revolutions you described came with enormous political upheaval. You know, farmers marching with pitchforks and union guys squaring off against security men with guns and all the rest. I mean, is this a time of bonfires burning and upheaval in the United States that you're describing?
Well, I think there may be a little of that. It may not be quite as dramatic, but who knows, really? But, for example, as this phenomenon of vulnerability to foreign competition extends to occupations that never thought of themselves as vulnerable,
like
the computer programmers, maybe college teachers, for example, my own occupation,
Watch out.
Radio hosts, your occupation.
Uh-oh. Here's Radio Bangalore filling in for me. Okay.
That's right. As it reaches these sorts of people that never thought of themselves as competing with foreign labor, unlike, say, steelworkers who have had that thought in their mind for 40 years, these portions of our population are not going to like it for very good reasons. Nobody likes competition that threatens their well-being. And a lot of these segments that I'm talking about now, the people that deliver services, cognitive services especially, tend to be more vocal politically. And they're going to let their politicians know that they don't like it one little bit. So you can almost see that kind of upheaval coming. Indeed, you can see some of it already, even though, as we said, it's only a tiny phenomenon up to now.
And you write that the societies of the rich countries, that's the U.S., Europe, seem to be completely unprepared for the coming industrial transformation. What preparation do you need to learn how to mow lawns instead of make cars?
Well, it's a good question. First, I think what sounds easiest but is not easiest, it would be nice if we had some data on this phenomenon. I said earlier when we talked about numbers that we really don't have any good data. We're working on scraps and fragments. So it would be nice to just to be able to monitor and measure the phenomenon. As you move to more important things, the first thing on my list is the education system. If I'm right that in the future, say a generation from now, we're going to have a much larger share of our workforce delivering personal services, both the low-level kind that you were talking about, the manicurist, and the high-level kind, lawyers and surgeons and things like that, we ought to be adjusting our educational system for those needs right now. You know, in large measure, we're still using a K-12 education system that was designed to deal with the first industrial revolution. Train people to show up at 9 o'clock, leave when the whistle blows, and work in factories. You know, there are going to be fewer and fewer of us doing that over time.
You know, you sound pretty cool about it, but it sounds to me like this revolution could be a very hot one, not a cool one at all.
It's quite possible. It's quite possible. We just don't know. I think the one good thing, well, one of the good things, is that it's coming slowly. This is not going to hit us like a gigantic tidal wave that in 1 year everything's fine and in 3 years later everything's terrible. It's a more of a drip, drip, drip. You used the bathtub analogy a moment ago.
On the other hand, 20 years, as one eventually learns, is a long way from forever. Alan Blinder.
Absolutely, and especially if you do nothing about it for the first 18.
Alan, I want to bring in a voice that's not quite as cool, calm, and collected about what's going on here, if I may. Joining us from Hong Kong, Clyde Prestowitz is with us. He's president of the Economic Strategy Institute, a public policy think tank. He's author of 3 Billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East. He's former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce during the Reagan administration. He led U.S. trade negotiations with Japan, China, Latin America, Europe. Clyde Prestowitz, thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be there.
Alan Blinder is describing a new, the next industrial revolution. He says, we've done it before, we'll do it again. You put things in different terms. You say you're jumping up and down, pounding the table. We're headed down the road. We're 10 feet from going over Niagara Falls. We've shot ourselves in the feet. How do you see it, Clyde?
Well, actually, I'm in Hong Kong. I just came here from Bombay and Bangalore. And while in Bangalore, I visited a company called Infosys, which is one of the top Indian companies doing technology and software and so forth. And while I was at Infosys, I had lunch with several of the American interns there.
Yeah, how are they doing?
They're doing great, but the interesting thing is that these are American kids who have gone to India to look for jobs in India, to work for Infosys in India. You know, it's not just that the job has been outsourced, but now the people from the U.S. are going over as well.
Okay, on a micro scale, we see that, but a lot of Indians have come here for a long time. Is that a bad thing? It's a globalized...
I'm not saying it's good or bad. I mean, in fact, these kids are great, and they're learning a lot, I think for them it's terrific, and they'll probably come back to the U.S. at some point and do good things. But the interesting thing is that the Indians who used to come to the U.S., are either not coming or they come and go back. They used to come to the U.S. and stay in the U.S.
So they now
come to the U.S., they go to school, and they go back to India, and the Americans who never thought of going to India are going to India.
When you say we're 10 feet from going over Niagara Falls, we've shot ourselves in the feet, what are you talking about? Do you share Alan Blinder's confidence?
I'm talking about more than just this phenomenon of outsourcing. I mean, our budget deficit is out of control. Our trade deficit is out of control. Our dollar is way overvalued. One reason why we're hemorrhaging a lot of these jobs and facilities are moving offshore is because the dollar is way out of whack. We're not investing in R&D. We're not investing in adequate infrastructure. We're not keeping... I mean, we talk about ourselves as having the leading universities in the world, and we do, but we're not reinvesting in the infrastructure in those universities.
So do you share Alan Blinder's confidence that we will move into this next industrial revolution, however it looks, and come out with an economy anything like what Americans are accustomed to, Clyde?
I worry more than I was listening to Alan earlier. I worry more than he seems to. I think there are significant differences between now and when we made these shifts in the past.
Like?
Well, in the past, you know, it's true, we moved from agriculture to manufacturing, but that's the point. We were manufacturing. We were doing agriculture, and then we had factories. And then we told ourselves in the beginning in the 1960s, as manufacturing began to leave the U.S., we said, not to worry, because we're going to do services and we're going to do high tech. But what we're seeing now is that services are moving and high tech is moving.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to Silicon Valley and talk to the venture capitalists there, you will find that they are actively financing startups that, you know, move the R&D to China or India.
So what's the next rung on the ladder? What are we supposed to jump to, Clyde Preston?
Well, that's the question. I think that's a very real question, and I think that it's something that we need to start thinking about real hard. Now, one part of this, again, I want to come back to this issue of the dollar, because the fact that what we as a country have outsourced, in a way, the management of the value of the dollar to Asia.
Because our dollar management has kept their products cheap.
Well, all of the major Asian economies are either pegging their currency to the dollar, or they are periodically intervening in foreign exchange markets to keep their own currencies weak and the dollar strong.
Can that really overcome the wage differential between the U.S. economy and China's? I mean, isn't that a marginal issue ultimately?
No, it's not. I mean, listen to what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese currency is substantially undervalued. It means that U.S. exports to China are more expensive than they would be under normal market circumstances.
But fundamentally, is it going to stop the movement of jobs? Can you really stop that by tweaking the dollar?
Well, I'm not talking about tweaking. I'm talking about the dollar is 50% overvalued.
Mm.
I'm talking about, you know, a major shift in the dollar. Now, I mean, that by itself is not going to change everything. But believe me, that you were talking about the radiologist kind of thing before. I mean, if you're talking about radiologists costing 50 or 80% less in India than they do in the United States, that's a very different thing than if they don't.
So the currency is a piece of it.
My point is that there are a lot of factors here that apply now that didn't apply in the past.
I want to bring our listeners in. A lot of them have lined up to have a say. Linda's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to make two points.
Yes.
One, in the past when we switched from one kind of product to another, mm-hmm. when we switched from buggies to cars,
yep.
we were still making something. But when we began to switch to a service sector, the American wages started to go down. And the problem is manicurists can't afford thoracic surgeons. House cleaners can't afford people who fill your teeth. So the one kind of service sector is so low paid that they can't afford the costs of the higher paid service sector.
We got
so
that.
So that's a recipe for catastrophe.
And your second point, Linda?
That was my second point. The change from making one kind of thing to another, we were still making things. But now when we're changing to a service sector, the people who provide the lower services can't afford the people who
right.
buy the higher services.
Well, we've got to let us look at it. I mean, making something, making me happy. Is that enough? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Alan Blinder, how about it?
Well,
she says the manicurist can't afford the thoracic surgeon, so it doesn't work.
I think that's correct in that instance. But I think the point is, if you look across the whole panoply of jobs and try to distinguish between, let's take service sector jobs, the ones that are personally delivered, like the manicurist and the brain surgeon, versus the ones that are impersonally delivered, like the call center operator and the, well, let's say just very routine computer programmer as opposed to customized mm-hmm. stuff, I think there's basically little or no correlation to wages. That is to say, it's not like it's only going to be the low-paying jobs that stay here and the high-paying jobs that migrate abroad. The migration's going to happen both at the high end and the low end.
Now, but we understand where the margins were in manufacturing. Where's the margin in a manicurist job that lets her become the kind of, you know, fully engaged member of the American economy, or him?
I hate to predict the future of manicurists, but I have a doubt that they'll ever be very high-paid jobs, right? You get to be a high-paid job by having more skill and higher productivity.
How many surgeons can we have in the economy?
Well, part of the answer is we're having more and more. We're living longer and longer. We have more and more procedures. And this has been a tremendous growth area for our economy. If you believe that we have to have more education, we're going to have more teachers at all levels, including college teacher, which is a high-paid occupation.
Tony's calling from Middleborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a computer program and support business, one-man shop. I've been doing this for 22 years.
Okay.
Used to be I had to go out, visit my customers, be hands-on. I now go out maybe 2 days a week, tops. Most of my business is on the Internet, and I get business from overseas. My point is that it flows both ways. Those economies are going up. Ours may go down a little bit, but as they go up, I can count on them for more business.
So they're going to make markets for your work. They're going to make work for you and your kids.
Exactly.
Tony, let us look at that. Clyde Prestowitz, how about it? Let's not worry. As India and China grow up as economies, they're going to create their own demand. American workers will, one way or another, serve that demand too.
Yeah, that's good to hear, actually. I'm glad to hear that Tony's been able to do that. And it's a good point. And, you know, we, as Alan said, we have insourced other jobs in other areas, so it's not a totally one-way street. But I think that what we're seeing is because of the cost differential. I mean, an engineer in Bangalore costs about 30% of what an engineer or programmer in the United States costs. Because of the cost differential, and because, again, as I said, of the overvalued dollar, there tends to be a tug in the other direction just because of the fact that you can get the same job done less expensively overseas. So the point is that if you want that to flow this way, you're going to have skills that those guys don't have.
The president says American workers can compete with anybody in the world. Clyde?
He says they can compete with anybody in the world on a level playing field, and it's just not true.
What do you mean?
American workers who have the right sets of skills can compete with anybody in the world, but many American workers don't have the right sets of skills.
Alan Blinder, what about the huge trade deficits, current account balance, imbalance that we're running, and all that debt, let's say, just to the Chinese, for starters? How ultimately that's got to be paid off. How do we pay that off with pedicures and surgery? Do we do surgery on Chinese businessmen in, I don't know, Boston or San Francisco? Does that work?
We do a little bit of that. We educate some of their youth. We do a lot of other things. I think the main, it's not the only, but the main answer to that question is we're probably never going to pay this debt off, but we need to stop accumulating it at such a huge rate. And the way we're going to do that, I do agree very much with Clyde, is through a cheaper dollar. The dollar is too dear. It means we're not exporting enough and we're importing too little. We've had these kinds of misalignments of currencies in the past, most prominently in the mid-1980s, and they correct themselves as the currencies realign. In this case, the currency realigning is going to mean the dollar falling in value relative to most everything. Now, is that terrible news? Not so terrible. Most of what Americans consume, even in this day and age, is still made in America.
At Walmart?
I don't know the fraction in Walmart. Walmart is, of course, a huge importer. But we do know the fraction nationally. Ballpark 15% of our GDP gets imported. Not 85, but 15.
Because those pedicures aren't imported, but it seems like practically every physical thing I buy is from, you name it, Vietnam these days.
In the case of things that can be put in a box, simple manufactured goods, the share of foreign merchandise is much greater. But as I mentioned before, as Americans have grown richer, and by the way, this is not just Americans. It's true in all countries. As they've grown richer, the basket of things they like to acquire shifts towards services, restaurant meals, vacations, medical care, education, and away from refrigerators and furniture and lamps and things like that, and toys and so on.
I still feel like Thomas Jefferson, unable to look past the agricultural economy into this new one. I still don't see the beef, Alan Blinder, and I can't tell if you're really describing it or if there's kind of a mystery spot here that you're just confident something will fill.
Yeah, well, I think it's more, it's a little bit the former, but mostly the latter. And that's why I brought up the Jefferson analogy. He could never have imagined how this was all going to work out. And I think we sitting here in the year 2006 can't imagine how it will all work out. It will work out. I'm confident of that. But I want to emphasize that doesn't mean there's not going to be a painful transition on the way. This transition from Jefferson's time to the 1960s, when the share of agricultural employment fell from about 85% to about 3%, was not without its pain. There were lots of painful adjustments.
To say the very least. Clyde Prestowich, you've watched the political pressures that can be cranked up around these issues in the past when Japan and its manufacturing were in the hot seat. What do you anticipate politically from the United States as it walks into this, I'm not sure, blender, meat grinder? Are Americans going to demand things we haven't ever imagined? Or some we have. Protectionism again? Subsidies for low-wage service jobs so that people can still participate in the economy somehow? What do you see coming politically?
Well, I think Alan is right. In the past, it's been these adjustments have been made, and we kind of forget the pain of those adjustments at the time. And he made a point earlier, I think he's very good, which is that the people who are being affected now by these adjustments are not blue-collar, you know, laborers, high school grads. These people are PhDs.
In other words, the blue-collar's already been hit.
They've already been hit, right. And so it's moving up the value chain here. And these people who are being affected now are more likely to call up their congressmen and more likely to be donors to political campaigns and just to be politically involved. And so I think that in the circumstances of, let's say, an economic downturn with much harder times than we've been having for the last 5 or 10 years, in circumstances of rising unemployment in the U.S., falling household income, and continued movement of, you know, kind of high skill service jobs abroad, I think things could get pretty nasty.
Let's take a call. Robert's calling from Boston. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well, what do you know?
Well, I have a couple of comments. First of all, I'm in the business of helping companies set up their global operations. I've been doing it for 20 years. And one thing that I see is, you know, just an amazing amount of, you know, incorrect or lack of data, as one of your guests said, in the industry.
So you're the guy who's facilitating the offshoring. Thanks a lot. How's it look, Robert?
Well, to be honest with you, I was an IT developer, you know, 15, 18 years ago, and I saw the writing on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something can be done while I was traveling around the world for one-third the price.
There's American ingenuity. But how does it look to you now, this conversation?
Well, I think, you know, there's a couple of things. I have a 14-year-old son that I have to go to home to every night, who happens to go to school in one of the top, you know, areas in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
From an education perspective. And he says to me every day, you know, you're outsourcing jobs. You know, what job am I going to have? Well, my father was in the construction business, and I tell my son, you can either go overseas to get a job to compete with the competition, or you can become a plumber. And the plumbers nowadays, I don't know when was the last time you tried to get a plumber, but they're doing quite well because there's a lack of those skill sets. So I have very strong, passionate views that it's the nature of the beast. The economy has changed, the world has become flat, and you either have to accept it and modify your skill set, or you become, you know, part of the equation.
But you're an IT guy, a high-tech guy, and you're telling your son, the next generation, to become a plumber. Nothing against plumbers. But we didn't imagine the world was going to be built in the 21st century on wrenches and pipes, the economy.
Absolutely. But I think that's, you know, you're going to have to create, each individual person is going to have to differentiate themselves, not from people only in Boston, but in, you know, Bangalore and London and China. I mean, you're going to have to create a value proposition around yourself as an individual, and that's what's very different about today.
No kidding. And, Robert, you've helped put us here. Good for you. Good luck in your conversation with your son. We know it's the big economy at work. Let me get a call from Columbia, South Carolina. Michelle's on the line. Hi, Michelle. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm a pre-nursing student, and, you know, there's a nursing shortage in the country now.
Mm-hmm.
And at the community college, once I qualify, there's going to be a 2.5 to 3-year wait before I can get into the nursing program because of the shortage of nursing teachers.
Okay.
You know, because they're paid so much less than they would if they were actually nursing.
All right.
And India, a lot of good nurses come from India to work here, and they have wonderful nursing schools that train nurses in India to pass the NCLEX exam, which is the RN exam here and everything.
So you're ready to go into nursing here in this country, which should be one of these jobs Alan Blinder's talking about, but you're still up against foreign competition.
Well, no, that's not my point. My point is that the problem is the waiting period to get into nursing school here in the States, and I'd be willing to go to India if they had a
school that would take you and turn you around. Wow.
A concentrated program, yep. If they had something where I could get a 2-year degree in 1 year so that I could pass the NCLEX, which is exactly what they prepare their nurses for.
Michelle, our time
there.
Is short. I got to let you go, but we hear Americans ready to be incredibly flexible. But Clyde, does this work in the end? You said you're afraid in the long run we look at less growth, lower standard of living, a lesser country for our grandchildren.
Well, it's interesting. Previous speaker made this comment that the world is flat, and what's interesting to me is that Americans have kind of so readily accepted the notion that this is just kind of happening. The truth of the matter is that while the world may be flat, it's tilted, and it's tilted in such a way by policies. I mean, I've already emphasized
mm-hmm.
the dollar policies that kind of tilt the world to America's disfavor at the moment. But there are a lot of other things. I mean, we say our future's in high technology, but some of the highest technology companies in the United States are putting their plants outside the U.S.
And a lot of capital with it. Clyde, we're out of time with that. We got the point, but it means stay tuned for a lot of politics to come, I guess we'd have to say. Clyde Prestowitz joining us from Hong Kong with the Economic Strategy Institute, author of 3 Billion New Capitalists. Clyde, we'll have you again. Thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
And Alan Blinder, professor of economics at Princeton University, author of the big article, Offshoring the Next Industrial Revolution. Alan Blinder, we're crossing our fingers and hoping your economist instincts are right, even if we still do feel a little bit like Thomas Jefferson. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for doing this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.